sometimes behave so strangely. Hello and welcome to a special episode of the So Strangely podcast on recent research in music and science, all about the 2018 meeting of the Society of Neuroscience that just happened on November 4th to 7th in San Diego, California. Instead of doing a deep dive into a single paper, we've got a panel of four neuroscience and music science researchers to talk about their experience at SFN18, what the conference is about, their own projects and things that they presented, and then into some other things that came out of this particular year's meeting, exciting results and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's going to be a little bit different, but it'll still be full of cool intradiscipline and interdisciplinary insight with, you know, the usual kind of discussion, but structured differently. So without further ado, let me introduce this panel.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
So into the specifics, we've got Professor Amy Belfi, who you might remember from episode one from the Department of Psychological Science at Missouri University of Science and Technology. Amy, can you give us a quick refresher as to what your sort of research is about?
Yeah, sure. So I, like everyone in this podcast right now, study music cognition, I guess. But I primarily look at music, emotion, and memory, and some stuff I guess you would call aesthetics and how we make aesthetic decisions about music, and dabble a bit in other forms of art, but primarily music.
Also with us is Avital Sternin, a PhD candidate in the Brain and Mind Institute at the University of Western Ontario.
I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Western Ontario at the Brain and Mind Institute. My PhD is focused on the neural correlates of music memory. So basically using fMRI, and we're getting into some new imaging techniques to try and understand what happens in the brain when we learn music and what happens in the brain when music goes from unfamiliar to familiar.
Also from somewhere in Ontario, we have Andrew Chang, the PhD candidate at the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience and Behavior at McMaster University.
Hey, so I'm doing how humans track the dynamic auditory information such as music and speech. I use multiple approaches like EEG, measure brain waves, and using motion captures to capture body motion. Also study the children with developing motor difficulties. But today I'm going to sharing about my works about how musicians coordinate with each other to play music together.
And last but not least, Dr. Keith Doling at the Department of Psychology in the Center for Neuroscience at New York University. Hey, Keith.
Hi, Finn. My work is more on the sensory side of both music and speech, looking at how the brain intakes musical information, and particularly on the temporal side, on the temporal dynamics. So how do we bring in certain rhythms and then train to rhythms in music and speech?
Today we're talking about the Society for Neuroscience meeting that just happened, and I have never been to this meeting. I have no idea what it's like. So what is this? Is this conference a big deal in neuroscience?
It's crazy.
It's the biggest one.
It's the biggest deal. Yeah, I mean, it's just huge. Everyone goes.
So how many people are there at this conference?
Typically, there's about 30,000 people
going
to this conference. And so it really spans everything that you can consider to be neuroscience, from, you know, molecular neuroscience to social neuroscience to, you know, the clinical side to basic side. It really just covers every piece of neuroscience that we can think of.
Wow. What kind of music science research wouldn't fit into this kind of area?
Basically anything that didn't involve human, or I don't know, I feel like there's even people who just present behavior SFN, even without any type of brain stuff. So, I mean, if you're just doing like mirror or something, maybe that wouldn't come into play at SFN, but.
I think any research to do with sort of like music, maybe pedagogy or like music technique, the sort of maybe like kinesiology side of music that you might expect in terms of maybe like musical disorders or musical injuries, that kind of thing, you probably wouldn't see in terms of music science at SFN. Okay. But I think other than that, basically anything goes.
Yeah, it's pretty broad. Cool. So then what actually happens? I mean, if you've got 30,000 people.
It feels to me it's like a five-day university.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like 100 parallel sessions. You have to decide like a course, which one I want to take. And for this morning, this afternoon, find my friend like in the middle to discuss the topic we're interested in. It's really like an umbrella conference. I can talk to like animal researchers on this part of my topic and also the human researchers on another part of my topic. So it's pretty cool.
Wow. Is it like a lot of talks or is it mostly posters or like?
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. I think for me, at least the most I get out of it comes at the poster sessions, which are happening kind of nonstop because you get to spend a lot of time with each person that you talk to and really delve into their research. But there are all also a ton of symposia workshops from like, you know, hour long lectures to small 15 minute lectures. So you really get a whole spectrum of scientific discussion.
Yeah, the poster sessions are 4 hours long. So you can be going to posters from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. every single day. And I agree with Keith. I think posters are where it's at. It's way better to talk to people than sit in a massive hall listening to talks, I think, at least. That's my perspective.
How do you navigate it?
I use the app. They have an app where you can add posters to your itinerary or talks or anything to your itinerary. Mm-hmm. And it's really actually nice to have that. Back the first year I went, which was like 2010, they gave you these massive paper booklets that you just would have to like leaf through. And it's so much better with the app. So this way now I know, okay, I've got these 10 posters I want to go to this afternoon. And here's where they're located.
Wow. And the nice thing about the poster session is because there's everything is there. You know, once you've seen the 10 posters you're interested in looking at, you sort of wander back through some area that maybe you didn't go to begin with. And you discover some area of research that you never would see otherwise, because that's sort of the joy of SFN that you have. You'll encounter research that if you go to a conference that's sort of niche or very specific to maybe music science that you wouldn't see anywhere else.
Okay, so in this context where you've got like all of neuroscience represented, how does music science stuff fit in? Is there much of it?
Not yet.
I feel like maybe there's more than there used to be when I first started going, but there's not a lot and it's a total hodgepodge. Like I feel like my poster every year is kind of in a random mix of posters because my poster was on emotion and Alzheimer's disease. So I think I was in like emotion section, but I was next to someone who was like looking at subdivisions of the amygdala or something. I don't know, something totally different. Or I could have been in the Alzheimer's section or.
Yeah, it doesn't have the same like category level that something like language or speech does. Because it's such a large language and speech part of neuroscience, they have their own sessions. And so you can go to one set of posters that are all about speech and language. So I don't think we're quite there yet, at least at SFN on the music side, but it does seem like that's changing some. I don't know if Amy would agree with me on that, but
yeah, totally agree.
There's more music stuff happening. Like, you know, we did have the big sort of dialogue in society about music and neuroscience there. So I think it's becoming more popular. Maybe in the next few years, that will be a new aspect that will be coming up.
Cool. So how is it received by the attendees then? Are people like aware that music science is a thing, or are they like, oh, that's so cool, you're talking about music?
I feel like I used to get a lot more of like, well, what's the point in this? Why would you study music? Blah, blah, blah. And then have to be like on the defensive for my entire spiel of my poster. Mm. I haven't really gotten that lately. I get a lot of people at my posters who don't do anything related to this at all and are just like, well, I like music. So I had a guy who was like, I studied Drosophila or something. I just thought this poster sounded cool. So I don't know if others had the same experience, but I get a lot of that. And a lot of undergraduates who are like, you know, music majors and neuroscience majors or whatever, people who are just personally interested in music. This is really cool. And less of the, why would you want to do this kind of thing?
I actually have some thought about, like, not my personal perspective, but from the big picture. Like, this year's opening talk is about the music and the brain, which definitely captured a lot of people's attention. And also, like, in beginning of September, in D.C., there was a series hosted by, like, NIH and the Kennedy Center Performing Arts. They have, like, a week-long event about the workshop about music and health. And even like having a show, like inviting several scientists, music neuroscientists with performers, they having a show together. So during the music performers in between, scientists explains their science, what they're finding to the general public. And also, I think NIH is going to announce a funding opportunity, which is specially dedicated to music and health research. Oh. So I think in the funding agency, big picture wise, there are people trying to push more about the music, cognition, music's health kind of research to the general biological scientists.
Interesting.
Yeah, they announced that a couple of weeks ago. And yeah, I was going to say the fact that Francis Collins has music as his hobby, I think helps music scientists. I mean, that's really pretty much why. Huh. But I think, hey, that's wonderful, because in the past it's been really hard to convince people, like I said, why this is useful, yeah, important research. And so it's nice to have an ally, I guess, someone who understands the usefulness.
Who is Francis Collins?
He's like the head of the NIH.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about your research. I have, through the magical powers of being the producer, assigned the panelists to summarize each other's work. And then we have a chance to do like a mini episode of So Strangely by talking about the how and why. So first up, Amy is going to talk about Avital Staranin's identifying the neural correlates of music familiarity using a strict training paradigm. Amy, take it away.
All right. I was really excited about Avital's poster. I thought it was super cool. So her question, I guess, was wondering how familiarity with music is represented in the brain. And Avital raised a really important point that most of the time when people look at familiarity in music, it's comparing music that people are already familiar with to music that people are unfamiliar with. Mm-hmm. And she brings up the really valid point that there's all other associations, autobiographical memories, things that go along with music that's familiar besides just familiarity, preference, liking, things like that. One goal of this study was to try and look at how familiarity is represented in the brain using novel musical pieces, which sounds weird, like familiarity and novelty seem to be oppositional. But what she did in the study was they created a bunch of novel melodies, and then they had people go into the scanner, and this is fMRI, and listen to the novel melodies. And then after the initial scan, they gave people a subset of these melodies to learn over time. And so they had to listen to these melodies, and then they tested them at the end of this training period to make sure that the melodies that were trained on actually basically became familiar. So people recognized these melodies, they were able to learn the lyrics of the melodies, and now at this point they're familiar with the melodies that they trained on, and they're unfamiliar with the melodies that they didn't train on. And when they created these melodies, you know, they were trying to control for lots of different musical aspects. So now we have like a very nicely matched set of melodies, that half of which are familiar and half of which are unfamiliar, and presumably the only difference between those is the familiarity. So then at this point, they
do a scan and they play people these
familiar and unfamiliar melodies and look for differences in the brain. And so something that I found really interesting was that, and Avital will correct me if I'm wrong about any of this in my summary, but I thought it was interesting that they didn't really find any main effect of familiarity. So looking at the brain, there was no difference between the melodies that ultimately became familiar and those that were not familiar, but they did find differences in areas of brain activity depending on the content of the melodies. So whether they had lyrics or non-lyrics or whether they were a cappella, these showed distinct patterns of activation in primarily like auditory regions. Avital did even some more complex analyses looking at multivariate analyses and fMRI that are probably beyond what I could try to summarize, so I'm not even going to try. But I think the main cool takeaway from this study is that it's, I think, a very rigorous test of differences in familiarity, because they're creating stimuli and doing so in a way that controls for everything except the familiarity of the music. Mm-hmm. And to find that there was, at least in an initial analysis, no difference in the brain between the ones that people knew and didn't know is really intriguing to me and cool.
Yeah, and it's honestly intriguing to us as well, because we really, like, I expected to see a pretty strong difference between familiar and unfamiliar music. And then at a first pass, when we didn't see that difference, it was really surprising. And that's one of the reasons why we're looking at using these maybe more subtle, more multivariate approaches in order to maybe find patterns of activation that we just didn't pick up sort of the first time around. to pull apart whether or not there is actually something there that is sort of the representation of the familiarity. You know, we have this evidence in Alzheimer's patients that remember songs from their childhood when they don't remember other types of memories. So there's something special about memory for music, but we don't seem to be seeing that here. I presented a very early step in this project. And so going forward, we're really interested to sort of pull apart what's going on in this context.
Where would you expect to see differences? Or when you started this, what were you thinking would show up as a contrast initially?
So we weren't actually sure, because we were expecting potentially differences in auditory regions. Once you become more familiar with things, generally activation in those regions go down. And so that was definitely something we were looking for. And we do see a little bit of that, but it's not specific to the familiar songs. It happens in the unfamiliar songs in the second scan as well. We think it's because now the participants are A, completely sick of us and of the music, and B, because they're used to the scanner, they've done this before. And so there are a lot of other things going on that might account for that. And sort of the next step of what I'm hoping to do is look in regions of interest, so very specific regions. And I'm looking in frontal areas that do show up in other experiments where familiar music has played a role in that experiment. And so I'm sort of diving into the literature to look at those areas to see if we just look within a particular region, are we going to see the familiar, unfamiliar differences?
Mm-hmm. This reminds me a bit of some work that's looked at people playing melodies and those sort of practicing effects, and how people hearing things that they're familiar with in terms of playing, there's been at least a little bit of research that has found differential activation in sensory motor areas. How much of that would matter for something that you've only listened to? I don't know. That might depend on the listener. But is that the kind of difference that you would consider?
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. And we are also looking in motor areas. We know that the motor networks are involved in music listening, whether it's in beat processing of rhythms or in like holistic music that has lyrics and instrumentation. The motor system becomes active. And it's possible that these familiarity effects are showing up in that network as well.
I think it's really interesting that you don't see this effect. Like you said, we would expect to see something like a decrease in auditory regions, and it's just clearly not there. And I'm wondering if in the effects that we have been shown previously, like you talked about, that there were things that they had listened to as kids, for example, things that they'd already liked. And I'm wondering if you had surveys about like how much they liked the music and whether that has any role to play in this familiarity effect, that they actually want to listen to it rather than being told to listen to it. I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that definitely plays a role. I do have ratings from each of these participants about how much they liked each of these songs, and I have them over time. So not only did they come in for the first and the second scans, but in between those two scans, they came into lab for a number of behavioral tests. And at each one of those lab sessions, I would have them fill out like a preference rating. How much do you like this stimulus that you're listening to? And I don't see a relationship right now between their preference ratings and the sort of the univariate analysis that I ran. I am planning on incorporating that into the multivariate approach because it might play a role. But I can say that, first of all, people didn't like songs more as they listened to them more, which I know there is this effect that you do like things more when you're more familiar with them. I don't see that in these stimulus, and that might very well be because I'm sort of forcing them to listen to it and they haven't listened to them by choice.
So how did you get the music? Oh, sorry. I see on the poster it says written by a lab member.
Yeah. So it was a lab member that had written them during his PhD a number of years ago. So the nice thing about it is that they were all of a similar style of music, and the voice that the participant heard, it was always the same voice. And then what we did is they had been recorded in layered tracks. And so some of them I just could easily pull out the instrument track or just the vocal track for the a cappella in our instrumental conditions. But then we actually did have him re-record the spoken word. Sort of he read the lyrics to some songs without any musical intonation. So we did do some manipulation on hand, but a lot of it was based on the recordings that he had recorded like some time ago.
That's convenient. Good recycling. That's good.
Yeah. And I could guarantee that nobody had ever heard them before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is not a dig at him, but nobody had ever heard them before.
Safe on a server somewhere. Yeah. Can you explain the multivariate analysis that you're doing?
Sure. So it's called a representational similarity analysis, or RSA. And the idea here is to look at patterns of activation in the brain from one condition to another. So we can say, when someone's listening to an a cappella song, are all of the little areas in the brain that are active while they're listening to a cappella, is that different or the same as the activation when they're listening to, let's say, just the spoken word? Understanding the differences in patterns, we can look at those comparisons across types of stimuli, across familiar and unfamiliar music, and we can do a comparison across people as well to see mm-hmm. whether or not those patterns are stable or idiosyncratic across people. Mm-hmm. And we can sort of define our models of similarity. I might predict that stimuli of the same type, so the different a cappella songs that I have, they might be more similar to each other than an a cappella song with an instrumental piece of music. And so I can mm-hmm. define all of these relationships that I'm interested in exploring and then see how well the patterns of activation actually map onto those relationships. So sort of as a first pass on the poster that I presented at SFN, I was looking at some basic models just based on the presence of language or of music or stimulus category. And those are sort of very simplistic models. And I don't see any significant relationship between those models and the patterns of activation. But I am exploring combinations of those models or adding in things like preference that I have in order to pull out maybe some better defined patterns of similarity.
Are you also interested in how those models, how the representational similarity analysis does as an effect of familiarity? So looking at the first session, is your model stronger, for example, in the second session than it is in the first, or something along those lines?
Yes, exactly. That is the plan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The little timer thing went off very quietly. So
I heard that. I was like, what is that?
I was like, whose phone is going off?
Yeah, no, it was my phone. Okay. So unfortunately, we're going to have to stop that here. But thank you, Avital.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, next up, Andrew presented neural oscillatory mechanisms for interpersonal entrainment in music ensembles. And it's up to Keith to lay out what this was about.
All right, cool. I actually got to look at this poster and talk to Andrew about it during the sessions. What Andrew did, I think, is really cool, is what is kind of a theme that's going on in neuroscience now is to take neuroscience out of the lab. A lot of the work that we do in music neuroscience, but really all neuroscience, is put somebody in a small dark room and you play them some sounds and you call it music, and then you see how their brain responds. But of course, that's not really how we deal with music in our day-to-day lives, right? And so what he did was to actually get recordings of a string quartet playing music together that actually know each other and play with each other on a regular basis. And what he has already sort of shown previously is doing analysis of this kind of data with body motion. And so looking at how the players interact with each other through their motion, and in particular, looking at how what he calls body sway is reflected in leader to follower relationships. So typically in a string quartet or any kind of chamber music that doesn't have a conductor, one person is kind of designated to be a leader for at least a portion of the clip. And so what he did that I thought was really cool is that he designated one person on each trial to be a leader, and the other three are followers who actually don't know who the leader is. And then looking at their body movements, can try to see how well does one person's body movement predict the body movements of another. And so you actually get these directional causal relationships between leader to follower versus follower to leader, and showed that the leader actually, as you would predict, actually does lead in not only in the music, but also in their body movements. And that's true not just in not just when they're looking at each other, but also with their eyes closed. So there's actually auditory amount of information that is being reflected in their motion. So what he showed at the poster was some new preliminary work using not body motion, but EEG. EEG allows you to detect small electrical fields from neurons in the brain. And so now, instead of looking just at how the body motions are changing, it's looking at how different brain regions are sort of communicating or reflecting each other in sort of across different people. So he had four particular ROIs that he thought would be useful: the prefrontal cortex, the auditory cortex, supplementary motor area, and then visual cortex. And looked at how those signals in each person were related to those signals in each other person, and again, in leader to follower relationships, both in sight and non-seeing conditions. And so what he found, which is, I think, pretty interesting, is that the supplementary motor area seems to be most relatable across people, and also in part driven by the lateral prefrontal cortex. So there's some interactions going on, potentially both within a person and across people, showing higher decision-making areas that are controlling these sort of body sway connections that we see.
Oh, it's a perfect summary. Thank you. You took my job.
Awesome. All right. So the body sway stuff, as I know it, has been looked at in explicit leader-follower roles in looking at causal directionality of motion. But in this case, you didn't let people know who was the leader. Why did you use that manipulation?
Yes. Yes, I acknowledge that we're not the first one doing the body sway on the, you know, like the music ensemble. But I think what we did differently from most of the previous study is that typically there's a leader, usually like the first violinist. There's a big confounding factor. We observe something leader like influencing the follower. Is that really reflecting the coordination, or they're just following the scripts they are being requested to do? Like, which is written, already written in the music. So what we did, just one small difference, is that regardless of which music part you were playing, even though you're playing viola, I mean, typically in many cases, in many genres of classical music, viola doesn't play much important notes. I'm personally a violist, so I think I'm fair to say that.
Okay.
But our experiment design is that we tell the musicians that no matter which position you play, no matter how boring the notes were, just be the roles we assigned to you. If you are the leader, act as the leader and lead the ensemble to play.
Great.
Actually, in the beginning, we were wondering whether this manipulation could ever work, because probably the violists never really tried to lead the ensemble. We're not sure. But actually, I mean, they are really good professional musicians. They turn out to be very successful. And after each performance, if you are assigned as a follower, you have to guess who the leader was. And turn out their guessing rate is like almost perfect. So even though you're second violinist, violist, you're assigned as a leader, you can still act as a leader. And that's really convinced us. I mean, yes, we can observe something which is above and beyond is written in the music. We can really measure their coordination. So I think that's a little bit more information we have found above the previous finding.
Yeah. Can you explain a little bit more about what's happening with what you think is happening with the prefrontal cortex?
So we choose these four regions because, I mean, auditory is essential for music performance. Obviously, you have to hear the sound. Visual is that you have to see each other during the coordination. Mm-hmm. Prefrontal cortex, we think, is interesting because based on the previous research, which come from a small isolated laboratory, those studies found that prefrontal cortex is associated with memory, attention, executive control. For example, you have to decide how to play the pieces, etc., etc. Another region we found interesting, like supplementary motor area, like Avatel said, like the motor region is playing important roles in music hearing, but also in music performing. You have to plan your actions, something like that. So we found those four brain regions should be a good starting point to look at what the brain is going on when people try to play music together.
Andrew, I wonder if you don't mind talking about that you see the effect also in the non-seeing case, and particularly in the body sway experiment. I'm wondering how you think about that, given that now the movements shouldn't actually communicate any information, and yet they seem to.
Right. So yeah, I agree with you. Then thank you for pointing out. I mean, because in the condition where they couldn't see each other, they're facing outwards, they like facing outside, so they couldn't see each other. So body sway shouldn't convey any meaningful information to each other. So what we feel is that maybe it's something like automatic gesture. Like when you're talking, even though you're talking on the telephone, your hands do the gesturing, you still have the facial expression, even though the people on the other side couldn't see that at all.
I'm nodding along to this and no one can tell.
We should record your body motion.
Yeah.
Yes. So we think something like this, a kind of automatic movement, could be psychological meaningful, could reveal some interesting meaningful information. And that's what we're measuring. And that's why we found, oh, even though they couldn't see each other, even though this communication channel is not useful, but can still be being informative to reflect their coordination structure.
Have you looked at the acoustic signals from in either one of these cases, really? Does the kind of body sway motion that they have, does that actually change how the sound comes? I mean, I'm not quite sure what the analysis would be, but have you looked at the acoustic side of this as well to see if there's some causal relationships there?
Well, that's very unfortunate about this case. We don't have that good quality of audio recording when we set up experiment. I mean, because we set up like 10 other measurements at the same time, we happen to have that tuned up very well. But actually, we have another study lining up, which students in our lab, Hector, he's running a study, have a duo pianist playing pieces together. And actually, their piano performance were recorded by their MIDI keyboard. So we can analyze the velocity, sound, onset in the very precise scale to investigate how that related to their body sway and also how that related to their brain waves. Hector also measured their EEG brain waves. But back to your original question, my speculation is that for string instruments, the body sway is not the mechanism for producing the sound. So producing sound is using the bow on the left, right direction, but the body sway is anterior, posterior. So that's interesting. I mean, why musicians do this kind of gesturing body, but which is not directly relevant to their sound production. That's a cool question. I don't know.
There's some interesting work on auxiliary gesture that's come out of some motion capture labs that have looked at this, and particularly with manipulations of emotional expressivity, because the visual side of it is really cool in terms of what it means to listeners and stuff like that. But oftentimes there's been a strong interaction between like how emotionally expressive someone is playing and how much motion they generate at the same time. So that's strongly related to each other.
So I kind of have, it's probably a silly question, but you use a professional string quartet. So these people are presumably familiar with one another's playing styles or already kind of in sync, I guess you could say. Would you expect this a similar result if you took people who hadn't typically played together before?
Right. That's a very good question. That they are musicians and they play together. They're definitely not ordinary people. We actually have another study. It's actually we measure their learning progress like over multiple trials to see whether they can play the piece together from the starting point. They never play that piece together. And to like after 4 trials, what's their performance going to be like? We even have their individual recording. So before they play as ensemble for the first time, we give them the music they never heard and never played before. So we have their individual preference, for example, the preference speed, the preference style, we have those recorded. And it's interesting to see how they're gonna like come together in the first round. Do they conflict? How do they solve the conflict over the few rehearsals? that's an interesting part, but the data still being analyzed, it's gonna be complicated.
That's verging on political. That's
yeah, how they compromise, the democracy or not.
Yeah. Oh, that's my phone. We have to move on to the next one. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
So next up, Avital, if you could introduce Amy's paper, Music and Emotion in Alzheimer's Disease.
Right. So Amy's paper was looking at exploring the question or the link between music and Alzheimer's disease, and specifically this question about why patients with Alzheimer's disease experience emotions even when the memory for whatever induced that emotion originally has faded. So they might feel a certain emotion, but may not remember why it is they feel that emotion. And so to look at whether or not that can be induced with music and to characterize what that emotional induction looks like. So in this study, they had a group of, I think it was 18 Alzheimer's patients and a group of 14 healthy controls, to which they played some series of music that was picked either by the participant or by someone who knew the participant. So they played 5 happy and 5 sad pieces to the participants. In order to investigate this emotional induction, participants rated their emotional state before they listened to the music, after they listened to the music, and then at 10 minutes and 20 minutes after the end of the songs, in order to see how long that emotion persists. There was also a couple of memory tasks. So participants were asked to identify the songs that they had listened, so those five songs that were happy or sad. And then there was a recognition task where participants heard some excerpts not only from five songs that were used to induce those emotions, but five other songs that either they had picked or someone that knew them had picked that said these might induce happy or sad emotions. And then five completely novel songs that were similar but were picked by the experimenter. And participants were asked to recognize which of those songs they had heard. And I guess overall, basically what was found was that, first of all, those songs, both happy and sad, induced the emotion that they were supposed to. And that happiness and sadness persisted for, in this study shown, up to 20 minutes after the end of the musical piece. And the healthy controls did better on the recall and recognition test, which is what you would expect. So healthy controls did better at remembering the songs, but the Alzheimer's patients also had this persistence of emotion, despite the fact that they did worse on the recall and recognition tasks. And so I guess the take home from this was that, in fact, music can induce emotions in participants or patients with Alzheimer's, and that emotion does persist even if they may not remember the actual piece of music that induced that emotion. I had a question, Amy, about your recall task.
Sure.
On the poster, it says that they were asked to identify the songs that they had heard. Were they asked to name the songs or just to identify, yes, I heard this song, or no, I didn't?
So for the recall, it was kind of like a free recall. So we asked them, what five songs did you hear? And they could identify them in whatever way they wanted to. So Elaine Bresky Hernandez, she's the second author on this abstract. She's actually collecting these data at Iowa. So this is a collaboration with folks at Iowa. Mm-hmm. She's a PhD student in music therapy. And she scored these, she would say, you know, tell me what pieces you just heard 5 minutes after they had heard them. And she told me she was pretty lenient in what she considered correct. So they could identify them by name, but that was pretty challenging. And so if they had said like, oh, it's a Frank Sinatra one, or it's the one that goes like this, and they hummed it back, or they'll said the lyrics of it, like that was all counted as correct. It was a total free recall. So they weren't given any cues. You know, in some other tasks I do, if they don't name it correctly, then the score is incorrect. But here, even giving any identifying information was scored as correct. And most patients overall did pretty poorly on the recall, even with that criterion.
I just want to reiterate how big that difference is. For recall, the control group was performing at like 80, 90%. And the group with Alzheimer's disease was at like 25% for recall. So that's a huge difference on a memory task. Really, really tangible, really obvious.
So in some instances, I'm guessing that these songs that were selected were selected by like a family member or a spouse to be used in the experiment. Do you know if they recognized those songs while they were playing? Like, did they say, oh, I know this song, and sort of give some indication that they recognize them in the moment?
That's a really good question that I would want to ask Elaine, since she was the person actually collecting these data. I would guess yes, since the patients were all in like an early stage. So I think that, you know, many of them had input into which songs were selected for the experiment. And I would presume that they showed recognition for the pieces when they were being played in the initial portion of the experiment. But we would have some good anecdotes, I think, from Elaine.
Okay.
She's on Twitter, so we can like tweet her when this goes live and get her answers to it.
Amy, I'm wondering about the interpretation here. First of all, the whole idea that music lasts longer, memory of music lasts longer in Alzheimer's, is totally new to me. It seems like that was actually kind of a big theme at SFN, so it's cool that this is being talked about. I guess I'm wondering, in this case, is the interpretation that there's an emotional memory that is sort of separate from the recognition memory that actually just is able to last longer? Or is it like a decay factor where like you're sad because you were just sad a few minutes ago because you were just sad a few minutes ago, and you might not actually know that it has anything to do with the music that you were listening to? Does that make sense?
Mood lasting. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think generally the interpretation is that it's kind of this dissociation between explicit memory for something and implicit memory for something, that this emotion persisting is a measure of some kind of implicit memory for the music, right? Because something's still there. They're still happy more. They say they're happier than they were before they heard the music, even if they don't remember hearing the music. So yeah, it's something's still going on there. And I think it's maybe this, you know, kind of implicit representation of the music that's showing itself by revealing it in their current emotional state. Huh. I also want to mention that this was like a basically a direct replication of a study from Edmarie Guzman-Velez, who's also on this poster. She's a postdoc at MGH. And she did this similar study, but with video clips. And so we all thought, like, let's just see if music does the same thing. And the data look very similar. Huh. So it seems to be the case that something that induces a strong feelings,
those feelings might persist
beyond the explicit memory. But something else that I want to look at that I haven't really looked at carefully yet is we've recorded like physiological, like psychophys measures. So I'm interested in maybe looking at those during the memory task to see if they show some other type of implicit memory indicator for the pieces that they previously heard.
Yeah.
Haven't got to that really yet, though.
That's so funny. I mean, I'm used to thinking psychophysiology being so separate from things like memory and kind of cognitive stuff, because that's the kind of things that I end up measuring a lot. And so I just kind of think like, oh yeah, that's just like the body. We don't really understand it, you know, internally. So whatever. And yet when I try to think about like that last time music made me happy, like I can't figure out how to think about it without going back always to what that music is. So like, it's just really trippy to think about this dissociation. Really cool.
So you looked at up to 20 minutes after the end of the music. Do you think that if you had looked at longer, that there would be a difference in how long that emotion persisted in the controls versus in the Alzheimer's patients, and how you might expect that to decay differently?
So when we look at the overall across both happy and sad, the averages are almost overlapping completely for both groups, the Alzheimer's group and the healthy group. Especially if you look at the 20-minute time point, the means are like almost the exact same for both groups. So I wouldn't necessarily expect any differences further out between groups based on the current data. It's an interesting question because it might be like, well, if you remember hearing the music, then maybe you would have that emotion persisting even longer than if you didn't remember it or something like that. I think part of the reason why we didn't look out further is because this is already quite a strenuous task for the patients, especially.
Sure.
It's a long, long testing session. But I think that would be interesting looking at like different rates of decay over time, I guess.
So, I mean, this is very cool result. I'm just wondering, since the music can induce emotion with patients with Alzheimer's disease, do you think it's possible to use this approach to somehow, for example, facilitate or even just retain their cognitive performances, memory, or etc.? Can this approach be helpful for them?
So there's been some work, and I don't remember who did it or when, but in the past several years, I think, where people have tried to actually, you know, improve memory for things by pairing them with music, or things like take your pill at 7 a.m., setting that to a tune or something in patients with Alzheimer's disease. And I think the general finding there has been that it might facilitate memory for the gist, but not for the details. So, oh, I remember that it was a tune about pill taking or something, but not enough to really facilitate
functioning, like necessary functioning.
The kind of like perspective we've been taking on it is it's at least from this, something we can do to maybe try to facilitate quality of life. Like, and I think especially for people like caregivers, like an encouraging take someone had on it was, well, this makes me feel good because even if I do something, you know, if I bring flowers to my grandmother or something, or if I give her a hug or whatever, and she feels happy, but then forgets what I did, I can still feel good knowing that maybe she still feels happy from it, even if she doesn't show any recognition for me. So I think at least at the quality of life level,
we're starting to see that music can be helpful in terms of how we could actually use
it to improve cognitive functioning. I think people are still working on that, and that's going to be an interesting challenge.
It's time, Amy. Thank you. That was a really great point to share. It's a really beautiful, hopeful point. But but yeah. Okay, we've got one last poster to talk about. It's Keith, and Andrew's going to lead us in that Akis Poster was assessing evoked and oscillatory components in cortical synchronization to music using computational models. And yeah, Andrew, tell us what this was about.
Okay, I feel this is an excellent poster, but it actually needs a prelude. So Keith published a very excellent paper a few years ago. I guess it's using the same set of data.
Yep.
It's about how measuring the human's brain responses using MEG to measure their brain waves while the participants were listening to a bunch of music. In Keith's previous paper, he found out that our brain waves is actually tracking with the musical beat. So for example, if you play the music with slower beats, the brain waves become a bit slower to track with the rhythm. When the music was faster, the brain waves will oscillate a bit faster, which was a striking result. And now everyone take it for granted. So thank Keith for providing that in the first place. I think for this poster, he's dived a little bit more deep into the neuroscience controversy part about the measurement. His maybe question to himself is that whether did he measure actually the neural oscillation responses which track with the musical rhythm, or actually measuring something else. The something else is usually what we call the event-related potential, or ERP, in the brainwave measurement. So that is kind of activities, for example, if we play a click of sound, just one click, your brain will have a spike following the click, which is not oscillation. It's not something could track with the external rhythm. It's just a passive reaction. Mm-hmm. So it's different from the proactive oscillation, which keep tracking. So that's a huge difference. So Keith is wondering whether he measured proactive oscillation tracking or reactive spike kind of ERP responses. So that's the measurement he's trying to solve. And also just in the bigger pictures, many researchers in this field, like including a part of my research, is debating, oh, whether we measure really is like oscillation proactive responses or reactive spike kind of activities. So Keith, he wants to solve this problem for everyone. That's cool. right. So Keith is using a very elegant and smart approach. So for oscillation proactive response, because that oscillation should follow the rhythm of the external regularity. If the rhythm was faster, the oscillation should also go faster. If the rhythm is slower, the oscillation will also go slower. But for the evoked responses, the passive reactive responses, the reaction doesn't speed up or slow down based on the rhythm, because it only cares about one individual click. So if he manipulates the inter-onset of the sound, he should be able to differentiate these two responses, because one, the oscillation tracking should vary with the time, but the reactive one shouldn't, because there should be a consistent time delay from the sound onset to the neural responses. So that's what he's measuring. So he used two computational models to model these two different processes, and he's able to find out, I mean, a little bit techy terms, I can leave this for Keith, but the take-home message is that the oscillation model wins. Actually, Keith is able to find out that our brains actually actively tracking the speed of the sound rather than just passively react to the sound. Well, actually, I just put a little bit notes. I mean, Keith also say, but still, the reactive part will still be measured by the same kind of a neural measurement, MEG measurement. It's really hard to dissociate both, but I think for the major part of the Keith's conclusion is that actually signal, like music, what we measured is not only just passive response. Yes, we can measure something. Its brain is proactively tracking the sound. Sorry, I may make a lot of mistakes. Sorry, Keith.
No, that was great. I just want to make one small change to what you said, which is that what we showed before was that cortical rhythms track the note rate rather than the beat. And because there's been a lot of work that's been done by people who like Jessica Gron, for example, and you know, some people who spent a lot of time on this looking at how there are lots of motor components involved in beat processing, which Avital mentioned before. And so I don't want to say that I've found beat processing. This is not that. What I really think of this as being like a much lower level process of like just extracting the individual notes from a continuous stream. So before we even get to beat processing, we have to know where the notes are. That's the kind of level that we're talking about. It's almost pre-music. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Don't want to get too much credit for stuff I haven't done.
Okay, so I have a question. You've got this image of a little head on your poster. I mean, it's, you know, it's a standard kind of localization thing. And if I were to look at this from the perspective of like fMRI or something, I'd be like, oh, look, motor area activation. I don't know what that pattern of activation or like concentration means, though, for MEG. Mm. Is it different? Like, what is the story of where all this activity is happening?
So the first answer to your question is that we are thinking that this is coming from auditory region. So like very primary, secondary auditory cortex and expanding out. The thing about MEG is that what you see on the scalp is not actually really what you're getting from the brain. And that's because of, if you remember from your physics class, the right hand rule, right? So there's basically what's happening is that there's an electrical current that's coming from a large population of neurons. And that's all pointing in one particular mm-hmm. direction. And then there's a magnetic signal that's sort of going around. So consider your electrical current to be your thumb, and then your other fingers are the sort of wrapping around that signal, so sort of like a donut. And so what you're actually seeing in the topo plot there is the front part of that donut and the back part of that donut.
Okay.
And so where the localization is, that is actually right in the middle between those two. There are a lot of different kinds of analyses you can do to actually, instead of showing it on the scalp, show it on the actual brain and where things are coming from. I've sort of, because I was so interested in the temporal dynamics, I sort of just focused on that rather than to say where it's mm-hmm. actually coming from. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I've sort of talked about it as if there's one oscillation that's happening, but really what's more likely is that there are multiple regions that are synchronizing to each other. It could be that the motor regions that are doing more beat processing type of things are actually synchronizing to the auditory cortex in a similar kind of way to communicate where the notes are, and then do the sort of beat processing analysis.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a question about the stimuli that you played to participants that actually mm-hmm. allowed you to pull apart this pro versus reactive?
Okay, so there's two experiments here. In the first experiment, we used a natural piano music. It's recorded on a classical album. Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, piano sonatas, all performed by Murray Pariah. What was critical about them was that we chose them explicitly for their note rate. So we have some that are very slow at about 0.5 notes per second, and some that were very fast, like 8 notes per second, and a few in between. I also want to, again, iterate that these, my kind of analysis is on the note per second rather than the beat per second. It's very, mm-hmm. it'd be very weird to have 8 beats per second. But what we saw in the previous study was that if you look at auditory cortex, you see synchrony that's specifically to the note. We actually didn't see a subharmonic kind of thing at 4 hertz in that case. And so that's why I sort of decided to focus on that level. So that was all natural music. And so that was also part of what we liked about the study was that it was using natural music. But the second part of our study here was used basically MIDI file versions of the same pieces. And so then we had perfectly rhythmic stimuli, but it also allowed us to really control the properties of the notes themselves. You know, piano has a very strong attack to it. And so I wanted to see, well, if you smooth that attack, can you actually reduce the evoked response and see and sort of get more of the oscillatory component in the signal? I sort of used MIDI files that had the sharp version and the smooth version to see, okay, do you see like more proactiveness in the signal than you did before? And the reason why I wanted to do that was to say, okay, we know that there is this reactive response, but is it part of the same oscillatory component, or can we actually separate the two? Are they two separate signals that are being mixed together? And so if you can reduce the evoked response but leave the oscillatory component the same, then you should be able to see that there's actually separately manipulable components that can be used for either, you know, for example, very predictable things, you might use the oscillatory component, and so very unpredictable, very sharp things, you might use the evoked.
What did this MIDI stuff sound like?
Basically like an underwater accordion.
Okay.
That makes yeah. sense.
Yeah, no, it totally does.
I wish I had an example to play for you, but
sing it.
Yeah, then we'll do that on the next episode.
Yeah.
So I feel it's very cool to measure how the brain track with the music. But I mean, like most of the real music, like the performers not just play following the metronome. Sometimes they speed up, they slow down, depends on the musical expressions. Like in the end of the phrase, sometimes people slow down. So I'm just wondering if the brain is really proactively tracking, whether the brain is able to track something, this temporal variation, and whether you can see that from your data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's not much I can tell you from my data, but I can tell you what I think about this. It's a point that comes up a lot, and also not in music, but also in speech. We talk about how oscillations are tracking to rhythms in speech as well, which is also not perfectly rhythmic. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that the oscillations in the brain are also not perfectly rhythmic. The idea is that they sort of contain information that changes over time, and so their cycle lengths change over time and things like that. So, you know, I think on some level it goes back to a very popular theory in music, that is that, you know, part of why we like music so much is that it's both predictable and not, right? So that you have some amount of prediction error, so you never actually know necessarily what's going to happen next. And I think that can sort of play into this as well. The reason why we like listening to this music is that you can sort of make predictions about when things are going to happen, but then there's a certain amount of delay or something, and that stretch provides you with some important meaning to what's going on in the stimulus. If you have something that's perfectly rhythmic, it kind of becomes boring because you can predict what's going to happen next. And so there's less information actually in the signal.
So probably like you mentioned before, like earlier, you think this kind of process is like a low level altered process. So probably it's a high level, well, do some top down, telling the low level, hey, you have to track this reason, be slowing down, don't speed up, something like that. interactions between like brain regions.
Absolutely. In my very low level world, I think of this oscillation as being maybe not top down, but side to side, at least not fully bottom up. But there's, of course, a more full top down experience coming from, let's say, motor regions or, mm-hmm. You know, more frontal regions that have information about what music is like and what you should really be expecting. And that also should be, you know, coming into this region as well and informing how we synchronize. But again, this is very speculative. I don't actually have data to mm-hmm. talk on that specific aspect.
Yeah, the way in which you constructed these models does bring up big questions about the adaptation that's happening. And I can understand that with this kind of experimental setup, you probably can't get that kind of fine-grade temporal information, or at least it would take very different shape stimuli to track that directly, because that's been a big part of how people have compared entrainment models is by looking at adjustments in what happens how. So I don't know, maybe that'll be something you can continue to explore, because I love it when this kind of math gets into experimental stuff. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for us, for me,
yeah, speaking of rhythmic onsets,
10 minutes goes fast.
That is it for this section. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, you all did really well speeding through things. Was this easier or harder than your poster sessions?
Easier. It was not 4 hours long.
I could sit down during this.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That is the other side of a 4-hour poster session. Ooh. That's brutal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, it must be really noisy too.
Yeah, shouting for 4 hours. That's what I feel. I totally lose consciousness by the middle of the day.
Okay, and now other stuff, music science research that you found at this conference at SFN.
Sure. So there was actually a poster from another lab mate of mine who also does music science work about rhythmic auditory stimulation in Parkinson's patients. Mm-hmm. The idea behind that project is sort of to help patients with Parkinson's who have difficulties with gait. So often they have this shortening of stride length and more of a shuffling kind of walk. Mm-hmm. And there's a sort of whole avenue of research that looks at helping them improve their gait length and stability by having them try to synchronize with music at particular paces to make them more stable. She brought some of the results from that project to SFN with her. And I think it was interesting that project looks at the importance of musical groove. In our lab, we define groove as the wanting to move with music. So if you are more inclined to move with a piece of music, does that make your ability to synchronize better? And she has data from controls in Parkinson's patients. And as far as I remember, I know she's having some sort of conflicting results that although there is sort of an increase in stride length, she's having sort of some funny results in things like stride width or stride time. And so she's working on trying to understand exactly what those what that rhythmic auditory stimulation is doing in both her controls and in her Parkinson's patients, in order to maybe implement further down the line. She's also an occupational therapist, to sort of in a clinical setting, how that could be potentially used to help patients.
Oh, that's so interesting that there'd be like a dimensionality to it.
Yeah, it's not just better walking.
Yeah. I suppose better walking was a bit simplistic as an expectation. So, yeah.
Yeah, there are a number of different gait parameters that can be measured. That so we have this mat in the lab that, you know, we'll measure your when your heel hits the mat, and how long your strides are and how wide they are and how much time you spend on 1 foot versus 2 feet, and all of those things. And optimizing that, though, all of those parameters together can help make Parkinson's patients more stable. It's just trying to figure out how best to get them to do that on their own. Yeah.
I saw a poster that was really interesting to me about building a neuromechanistic model of rhythmic beat generation, which is from another lab at NYU, actually, but that I actually had no idea that was going on. And basically, the process of beat generation is actually much more complicated than we would actually think that it would be, largely because, like, a lot of beats actually are not necessarily present in the music. So, like, if you have a very syncopated beat, you might actually not have that particular time constant actually present in the music, and we just kind of infer it. And so, you know, how can you build, you know, how do you actually do this process? And actually, it's, you know, if you look in the animal literature as well, it's you know, only very few animals are actually capable of tracking to a beat. So it is actually a very complex process. And so there are some new process, sorry, new poster here that's looking at how to build a computational model in order to do that, which I think is awesome, because there's not been a lot of work on that. I mean, so there's been sort of one very popular model by Ed Large that has sort of a series of oscillators that entrain at many different rates. But so they're trying to sort of pare it down and sort of look at one neuron and see, can you get one neuron to synchronize with the right kind of circuitry? And so I just think that, you know, having more computational models in music can only be good, right? So that we can actually really get looked down mechanistically and see, how do we actually do this thing that we all love and you know, and that we all enjoy so much. So I thought that was very interesting.
One of the challenges of the pieces that I keep on missing when I look at computational models of things like meter and beat and entrainment is the fact that behaviorally we pick up a beat very quickly. Like, if you look at any kind of oscillatory system, it's usually built to be passive. And then there's this kind of gradual acquiring of a beat over several cycles. And yet what we end up doing is, like, it just, like, turns on. Like, you need three sounds in a row and then we're with it. And that's a really, like, important and confusing thing that we do. And it's also really hard to capture, because, you know, if you're only looking at what a passage of maybe like 2 seconds, like, what do you measure over 2 seconds to capture that, let's say, you know, if we're wanting to capture how that process begins? So it's complicated. So we need computational models to start tearing this, you know, apart and building this stuff together. So
yeah, definitely.
Anyway, yeah, we definitely need more models. We definitely do.
Yeah. One of the things that's nice about this model is that it does actually pick up the beat fairly quickly.
Oh, good.
You know, within 3 or 4 cycles. And it mostly does it by looking at the inner onset intervals. Right? And so you kind of just you look at the time between note 1 and note 2, and then do that again for note 2 and note 3. You can take the average of those and sort of keep going, which is very simple and probably doesn't give you the very complex aspects of beat processing, but it's a nice start to see, you know, okay, you know, now we can use that as a starting place and then compare that to behavior and then, you know, add more things to it. So, I think that's particularly with things like speech and music, where we don't have the animal model that we can really dig into. Well, I shouldn't say not have, but have to a lesser degree. I think computational models are going to be very important in trying to drill down to the mechanistic explanations of how this stuff happens.
Yeah.
I found a poster which is by Sam Norman Hagner. I'm not sure how his last name is pronounced. Sorry if I'm wrong, Sam. So his poster is about distinct neural selectivities for music, speech, and songs in human auditory cortex. I found that interesting because, I mean, essentially, he found the regions on the auditory cortex is like specific reactive to songs, speech, or music. So what he have, I remember what he have done is that he found the patient who's going to have like a surgery, like brain surgery because of seizure or other occasions. So for those patients, when waiting in hospitals, they have the electrodes put right on the surface of their cortex, right on their brain. So like waiting for like a seizure happening so they can measure their seizure. But at the same time, the patient just sit there and waiting. So usually like researchers come in, ask them whether they want to participate to do an experiment. In their case, they play a bunch of sounds, including natural sounds and also music, speech, and songs. And the nice part about this kind of data is that you can have a very clear recordings compared to MEG or EEG, which we usually measure outside of the scalp. So you can have a direct recordings on the auditory cortex. And then he used his computational model to decode which brain areas, like which specific electrodes on which brain regions with very high resolution, with high spatial precision, to know whether which area is like specifically reactive to music, specifically reactive to speech, and specifically reactive to songs. And he found out, yes, there are neurons just specific to one of those. So I think this is a pretty cool finding to see, oh, like, even in very low level, like auditory cortex, there's some selectivity that happens there. So like maybe those informations got divided up into different processing pathways in at the very early stage. That's a cool result for me.
It is very cool to me as well, and particularly because I think a lot of work comparing music and speech has been trying to find the similarities. And you know, there's a syntax for music, or how does music affect your language in different cultures, and these kind of things. And this is one that's really trying to say, okay, actually, no, there are some real differences. And so not only is it, I mean, of course we know that there are differences, but trying to look at, you know, what are the specific differences and where are they in the brain? So I think that's, it's very cool to see that from a low level. I'm excited to see in the future what comes from this, because what I really want to know is, why? What is it that these neurons have picked out to identify this being music versus speech? Part of what he's shown is that it's not the very simple, you know, spectrotemporal modulations. It's not the sort of different like acoustical statistics. So, maybe it is something like, you know, what are these music neurons doing? Are they doing beat processing? Are they doing pitch tracking? How is it that you get these kind of effects? But so hopefully that will come soon.
Totally agree.
That reminds me a bit, Avital, of what you were doing in terms of comparing a similar set of stimuli, although obviously you didn't have the opportunity to record so closely to the auditory cortex. What is your thinking in terms of having activation, let's say, for something like a cappella, when that's different from speech from the same voice or an instrumental melodic segment? Like what could be special about that? Do you think it would just be an intersection according to what you've looked at, or would it be something else entirely?
Yeah, so that's interesting. So some of the data that I have in fMRI, so it's really different modality than this than this paper or this project. But some of my results show that it's not just like a combination. So, you know, if you expect sort of an additive effect, then you might think there's some activation in relation to the speech. There's some activation that's coming in response to the instrumental. And when you put them together, you get some sort of additive combination of the two. And our results are showing that that's not exactly what's happening, that there is something special. And it could be something to do with sort of tracking that melodic, the shape of the melodic intonation or whatever it might be that is causing some kind of different activation that you don't see when it's, you know, just spoken words or when you have musical instruments, that there's something interesting happening when you combine the two. I don't have a good answer, but I think that it's something more interesting than just sort of like 1 + 1 = 2.
I saw one actually from the Zatori lab in Montreal, which actually talks about something that I was mentioning before on the temporal side, but looking more at content, about predictability and uncertainty and the relationship with pleasure and music. Mm. And so what they did was to look at basically play music for people and then sort of quantify on a note by note basis how predictable is the next note given the previous set. And basically what they showed behaviorally is that, you know, how much the participants liked, they had a sort of continuous rating of liking the music, and they can see that there's actually a sort of U-shaped curve, so that people don't like things that are too predictable and they don't like things that are sort of way out on the outside, but, you know, there's sort of like sort of sweet spot of like how predictable something should be that you can actually sort of, it's not quite what I expected, but that, isn't it cool that they did that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Then they also, you know, did this in fMRI because why not? And also for many,
if you have the machine, why not use it? Yeah.
And the funding.
Yeah.
And also for very good reason, you know, because they're looking at nucleus accumbens and basal mm-hmm. ganglia effects, see that show that they're actually reward effects by these prediction errors. So I thought that was a very cool way of investigating this sort of, because I think it's a very popular theory about sort of the effect of predictability on pleasure, and I think there's mm-hmm. some data on it, but you know, this really sort of gets down into mm-hmm. sort of into the meat of it and sort of really shows the effect kind of nicely, I think.
Cool. So were there any non-music science projects that you thought were, you know, important and interesting that maybe relate to music science? What were your most exciting takeaways?
I found in general that in this year, there are more and more people doing computational modeling, mm-hmm. like even on the like neural, like deep neural network. And I think those approaches has become like very mature, get mature very fast in the past few years, probably mm-hmm. just this year. And people have using this approach to analyze the more complicated data, which can never be analyzed before. Mm-hmm. So like we can analyze multidimensional data, like more natural data, such as like music listening and brain waves in multidimensional way. And I think just in generally, I feel it has a bright future to apply those approaches to analyze more complicated things. And that, mm-hmm. that can be also applied for music cognition as well.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely true that that's a big trend that's been going on in the neuroscience field for, for 3 or 4 years, but particularly it was very clear at SFN this year. One thing that I worry about in the use of these neural nets is the kind of absence of theory, I guess. And I think one thing that will be important in the future is to sort of, you know, using neural nets in music cognition is to also remember that there's a lot of good work that's been done on the musical theory side, and that things like cadence and different featured musical phrases do exist. And so trying to put those two things together, both having, you know, just large amounts of data that you throw a neural net at, but also pairing that with the sort of top down, I guess, the sort of behavioral side will be a sort of interesting conflict that we're going to have to manage over the next few years. So I think it should be very interesting and exciting.
Yeah, totally agree.
It sounds like the neuroscience is catching up to music information retrieval in terms of techniques.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Wait for us. Funny.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. But yeah. No, good. Yeah. It's good. It's all the tools are very exciting. So that's good to hear.
One thing that's new that has come out of our lab recently from Florencia Asoneo and Pablo Ripollas, they're working on sensory motor synchronization. That's one place that I think those two things will come together in the music case a lot. And so what they've shown is that in the speech case, they have a very small, simple task. People listening to syllables that are just presented totally rhythmically, and they just have them whisper along, just ta-ta-ta-ta-ta along to those syllables. And what they show is that half the population synchronizes and half the population doesn't synchronize. It's totally spontaneous, right? You get this sort of weird bimodal distribution. And so what they're showing is that effect actually is not just a, you know, fluke of, you know, some people are paying attention, some people aren't, but actually has bearing on the structural differences in the brain and also functional differences. So you actually see stronger auditory to motor connections if you look at sort of tractography, the sort of more wiring between auditory and motor regions for the ones that are higher synchronizers. And also they have, I don't know if this was in the poster, but I know this, they have a little bit more musical expertise. Mm-hmm. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how that manifests down the road. That's a interesting, kind of weird, sort of easy task that you can use as a way to almost diagnose these people as having higher or lower auditory motor connections.
Huh. That brings up so many questions of like, you know, are people musicians because they do this, or is this something that comes with musical training, or, you know, and if there are musicians that don't do this, and, you know, like to have that sort of immediacy of mimicry or whatever, however you want to explain it, that kind of phenomenon sounds really, really cool. So, well, it's something to keep an eye out for in the future.
Absolutely.
Just a last thing I want to touch on is I know that one of the big events of this conference was this kind of like music neuroscience presentation thing that was maybe like a public science event.
Basically what it was is this thing called Dialogue with Society at the Society for Neuroscience. And I guess they do this every year with a different person that's outside of the neuroscience field. So it's been done with a chef, with a writer, you know, these kind of things.
Okay.
And so this time around, they had Pat Metheny, who's a very famous jazz guitarist, come to sort of speak about his experience in music and then try to relate that to what we know about music neuroscience. And so it was, so he spoke for, I don't know, about maybe 20 minutes. And then they had a sort of discussion with him between the SFN president, Pat Metheny, and another researcher.
Charles Lamb.
Charles Lamb, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Charles Lamb, okay.
Yeah. So who's done a little bit of research on jazz improvisation and using MRI. And, you know, I think what I really did like about it was hearing from Pat Metheny about what his musical process is like. You know, they asked him questions like, you know, when you play an emotional piece, are you actually feeling that emotion and trying to transmit it? Or are you just sort of inside the music and just trying to like play the next note at the correct moment and correct time? So, you know, I think that's an interesting question, particularly for somebody that's playing music every day of his life for the past 30 years. And so basically what he said was that he's very much just in the music. You know, he has sort of a full experience just from trying to play the music the right way and sort of get the right through. He's really not feeling that emotion. Just personally for me as a person who also started out as a musician and like that's, it's interesting on its own, but I think it's also important for neuroscientists to listen to something like that because eventually we're trying to explain that behavior. Right. Look, we can't do it now, obviously, but at the end of the day, we want to know as much as we can about the behavior that's going on so that once we get to a more clear understanding of how everything's working, we can actually say, oh, this is the target that we're trying to explain. We want to have something that's not just transmitting emotion to emotion, but also really focusing on the music, like, you know, on that kind of level. And where it struggled a bit was in the trying to connect it directly into what's going on in musical neuroscience, and neuroscience generally now. And that's because, you know, we're very early in understanding how anything in the brain works, much less something as big and complicated as music. And so, you know, they weren't quite speaking to the same level of understanding. I didn't think. And so that part was a little difficult. But you know, I think it is very important to hear about the behaviors of things that are sort of outside of what we're already doing, so we know what the target is that we're trying to explain.
Was there a lot of people attending? Was this important for the people at the conference?
Oh, it was huge. I would guess 7,000 people or something like that. I mean, I don't know. A large portion of the, you know, it was sort of in the largest lecture hall that we had for SFN, and it was pretty much packed.
The scale of this conference just keeps on blowing my mind. Like, it's just, it's so big.
I mean, it was in the same convention center that Comic-Con was in, right? San Diego Convention Center. So I'm sure Comic-Con is larger, but it's on that scale.
Do people camp out overnight to get into specific lectures? Like,
No, it's much less exciting than that. So, you know, some rooms do get very packed, but nobody's camping out the night before.
Maybe in 4 or 5 years, we'll see. Maybe yeah, if we we'll get more there. Music science there, you know, bring in the arts representation, that'll change the dynamic a little. All right. Well, are there any final thoughts about this conference or your experience at SFN that you want to share?
Well, this was my first SFN, actually, and I had a great time. So in terms of closing thoughts, it was great.
It is always very fun.
It was fun.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think it is definitely a great conference because it allows you to sort of get outside of your normal experience, although you also do some of the stuff that's in your normal music, your normal field. Mm-hmm. But it allows you to connect to a lot of different other topics in neuroscience and sort of try to glean some things that you might not have seen or get input from people that don't have the same kind of perspective that you do.
Absolutely.
That can be very helpful. It sometimes can be make it very difficult, but I think at the end of the day, it can be very useful.
And one other thing that we didn't talk about at all, but I'll just mention, is that every year they do a music social, which there's sponsored socials about like hippocampus and pain and things. But this one is neuroscientists who perform music. So you can kind of sign up for a slot and then it's like everybody plays their instruments and it's kind of fun. So.
It's a jam session between neuroscientists.
Yeah.
That's pretty sweet. Maybe someone's collecting data there.
No, that would be better.
Oh, hey, next year.
Next year. That's a project. Yeah. You're all courses.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all of this stuff. This is like a huge amount of information. And I'm sure our listeners will enjoy sorting through both the facts and the interpretations. So, thank you, all of you, for coming on.
Thanks so much. Thanks.
It was fun.
And that's it for this episode of the So Strangely podcast on recent research in music science. So if you like what you heard, or if you want to support the podcast, consider reviewing it on iTunes or wherever you listen, and share your favorite episode on social media. And if you want to get in touch, you can follow us on Twitter at So Strangely Pod, or find us on the blog or on Facebook on the So Strangely podcast. And if you're music science academic with your hands on a new publication, or if you have just come from a conference that had all kinds of fun research that's worth sharing, get in touch. There's a contact form at our website, sostrangely.com, or you can always email me directly, finn@sostrangely.com. So thank you for listening. And until next time, keep digging into how and why music sometimes behaves so strangely.
Sometimes behaves so strangely. So strangely. So strangely, so strangely, so strangely.